I'm here for another 2 weeks. I'm based at the University of Münster in Germany. I'm interested basically in understanding the molecular basis of it. So I work on Arabidopsis thaliana essentially because you can do very deep genetics in Arabidopsis. And I work with a number of different traits, and one of them is actually immunity. And so the work I want to present here is what we've done in trying to track down the evolution of the plant immune system. And I'm going to present you the evolution of a receptor that's involved in the perception of flagellin. So as a very brief introduction, I mean, flagellin is sort of the essential mobility protein of bacteria. It allows them to move, and so it is a component that's under very, very strong constraints for evolution. It is really pivotal for bacterial life. And this is this molecule that is being detected by the immune system to sort of trigger the first step of defense. And what is interesting is that plants have all the receptors specific for flagellin, and humans, I mean mammals and vertebrates, have a lot of receptors that look very similar but have evolved independently. So the reason why I started working on flagellin sensing is because I was based for a few years at the Max Planck Institute for research in Cologne, and Sokol Robacek was one of the persons who cloned the genes, and so there was a number of technologies that were available at the Institute that we could use now to characterize the natural variation with respect to the perception of that molecule. And so this is the work I'm going to show you, and I've tried to expand this into sort of a view of how the immune system can evolve in Arabidopsis thaliana. So there's actually two talks together. I have about 30 slides to show. I wonder whether, as far as I heard from the previous talks, maybe I won't reach the number 4. But please feel free to interrupt me. And if I see that there's a question that I'm asking later, then I'll say, okay, I'll answer that later. But I'm going to make an effort to introduce the biology to you, and I'm not sure I will meet your expectations in that sense. So if you feel like I'm just sufficiently well, just let me know. So that's the major introduction I wanted to give. It's a schematic representation of the plant immune system. So you have multiple layers, and along this axis is the amplitude of defense. And you have a certain threshold of defense to reach so that according to how bad the pathogen is, you're going to have to adapt your defense. And so there is different levels also in this direction in terms of specificity. There is basically what people know now as the broad spectrum defense system that is actually triggered by these so-called MAMs. I don't know if you've heard about them. It's their molecular, microbial-associated molecular patterns. They're also called sometimes PAMs, pathogen-associated molecular patterns. It's basically those specific classes of microbes that plants as well as vertebrates can perceive very well. And so you perceive these molecules that are typical of microbes, so sort of typical non-self molecules. And you have a first layer of defense that is being triggered. And this is what you see with this green arrow, which is the response of the plant. And it's not triggering the strongest defense response, but it's also already triggering something that's sufficient to fight off most of the pathogens, the potential pathogens that are around. So this level is already quite efficient. And then what happens is that the pathogen has other means to penetrate molecules that are called effectors that are able to block or downregulate this first response. And so in the face of these specific effectors that some strains have and that are able to downregulate the first layer of defense, there is a second layer that is known to be more specific, and this is a strain-specific defense. And the second layer is provided by so resistance genes, they're encoded by resistance gene, and they are specific of the effectors that is used by the pathogen. So they have their efficiency is much more restricted in terms of the number of strains that they can target, but they can trigger very strong defenses, and this very strong defense often is called the hypersensitive response, and it can lead to cell death. So basically all the cells around the area where the pathogen is trying to penetrate are being killed, and so that there's in the end no real disease. You just sacrifice a few cells. And then you have other pathogens, effectors, that have evolved just to downregulate or to block the effect of these the action of these R genes. And so you have this sort of coevolutionary zigzag model where you have R genes, effectors that downregulate those R genes, other R genes that again targets this effector or this the interaction between the effector and the R gene, or simply another effector. Okay? So what I want you to remember from this is that you have this broad spectrum defense system and then this strain specific defense system. And what we thought when we started working on phagenin perception is that this should evolve differently, because this one is a lot broader, and so this one will always retain some sort of ecological relevance.
Who's this? Anders Holson works. I mean, how it works, right? I mean, in mammalian immune systems, there is blood that sort of carries the immune cells around, and so on and so forth. So how?
You don't have immune cells. Everybody has the same to fight off the pathogen.
Every cell is doing this, right?
Yeah, basically.
And
so they kill themselves, actually.
Pardon?
So if you have a strong response in cells, that's just
this is irrespective of the actual cell fibers on the surface, inside, somewhere.
Well, I mean, usually they penetrate through the surface, right? So that's the first layer where it happens. So it's usually the epidermal cells or the first mesophyll cells below the epidermal. And I come back to that, but they penetrate through these openings, so the plants breathe, right, and gas exchange occurs through these stomas, sort of cell mouth, and this is the preferred penetration location for bacteria. And so quite often it's around these points that you have these reactions. But all cells are identical. You don't have any circulating cells.
Do we have some kind of an ODE-style model, sort of similar to what exists for human immune response, right? Ecological style models. Do they work better, prey, something like
that?
Yeah,
yeah.
For the
system.
You have that,
yeah. I'm not going to talk so much about the models themselves, but there's a lot of literature trying to explain why you would maintain polymorphism for these R genes and sort of these trench warfare systems where you would have variation in frequency, so co-variation in frequency between the pathogen and the host. And you have a number of models also that are trying to explain where you have, I mean, there's these arms race models where you have succession of specificities. I mean, the thing that's specific to plants was that very early on, as early as in the 50s, people knew there was genetic variations for specific strains segregating in natural populations. And so that they had very early this idea that you have genetic couples specific to a strain and a host, and that's this, when these two specificities meet, then you have the resistance phenotype. So very early there was this gene for gene evolution models that were developed. Yeah? We can talk a bit more about this afterwards, because this is in the end touching to once I'm trying to put all this into the bigger picture, we might understand this better. So phlogenin receptor. So phlogenin is one of these MAMs, and the phlogenin receptor has been cloned. It's an RNA. This structure is very good for interacting with other proteins, and so apparently there is a direct interaction between this RR and the phlogenin residue, which is called, it's a fragment of phlogenin that is binding to this. And then you have a transmembrane domain, and linked to it, this kinase domain that is able to directly transduce the signal to the inside of the cell. You have a number of reactions that have been very well characterized, and this is why this model was so interesting to study, because you have a number of defense reactions, so colors deposition, the emission of reactive oxygen species, ethylene production, and also at the transcriptome level, you have over 1,000 genes that have been changed in their regulation. And what was also interesting is that there is a very interesting phenotype in it that's related to plant performance, where you have, we can see that inhibition of growth. And it's been shown to be an active response mediated by the downregulation of these auxin receptors. So auxin is the hormone in plants that's responsible for growth. And so the downregulation of the auxin receptors probably participates to the to this blocking, this active blocking of growth. So that, I mean, one interpretation to that is that possibly the resources are being set free for defense. And so having this defense response, this growth response together, this also suggests that you could have a set of trade-offs between growth and defense. So we, the gene was cloned, and we started our study by sequencing the gene and doing a classical population genetic study, and I'm going to show very briefly the results we had there. So this is along the sequence you have, I'm not sure you can see this, but this part is the LRR, and then you have the kinase domain. And what we saw was that overall there was no signature of diversifying selection, as you could expect for classical R genes, right, that are co-evolving with bacterial effectors. But what we find instead is that the pattern of variation, like as revealed by Tajima's D, for example, changes along the sequence. And also, this was the case for the Fehl-Buz index that is characteristic for an excess of high-frequency derived variants. And so we've seen that, and then we were like, okay, let's try to have a closer look. How does that match the expectation for the rest of the genome? And we did something that has been developed by other people. That's a compound test where you simply look at the distribution of a number of population genetics and summary statistics, and you look at the distribution of these different things together. So each point here is one locus. And for Arabidopsis thaliana, what is interesting is that we have a lot of population genetics that has been done on them. So we had information for the variation on these 800 and so loci. Actually, this data is because now people have the full genomes for these accessions. So. And so here we plotted the normalized Fehl-Buz estimator and statistic, and here the Tajima statistic. And you see that for this point is the point of FLS2, and what I computed is basically the probability to observe the combination of values that are smaller than this -4 for the Fehl-Buz statistics and for the Tajima C. It's very rare in the genome that you observe for the same regions both a negative Fehl-Buz and a negative Tajima C. And this is also the case if you combine this estimator, this Fehl-Buz estimator. Yeah.
Can you please tell us in short and simple words what the Fehl-Buz and the Tajima represent?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So the Fehl-Buz is actually calculating. So if you look at the frequency spectrum, for neutral mutations, you have a lot of low-frequency neutral mutation, very few, very high-frequency. And the Fehl-Buz is somehow quantifying how much you have at the high-frequency level. So it's quantifying whether you have an excess of high-frequency derived mutations, which is what you would find if you have natural selection. And the Tajima's D is on the pairwise numbers, if you compare each sequence pair by pair, and the other one is simply the number of mutations that you expect. Normally, these two numbers should be equal, and if you have an excess of low-frequency mutations, then the distribution is going to be negative. An excess of low-frequency mutation is what you expect in their sleep. I'm not an expert on that, so...
Yeah, I have a question. So isn't it that four
counts the mutations on the external branches?
Yeah.
So now... So then, if you've got like a star-shaped topology, you'll have long external branches, so that will give you a negative Fuhn Lee, but it also gives you a negative Tajima's D, because you have an excess of mutations on pairwise, on pairs of long branches.
Yeah.
So both will be negative.
Yeah.
So that's the standard situation.
Yeah.
Ah, okay, right.
Yeah. So the genome, if you look at the values, they're pretty much skewed towards negative values because the population is in an expansion.
Yeah, sure.
But it's very, what you don't expect is to have both. So what you expect in the sweep is you have both. And there's very few loci for which you have both. This is basically what this is saying. And so for us, it's a sort of reliable way to say this is really a genomic outlier.
Yeah.
Juliet, can you also tell how do you define the shaded area?
Oh, very simply. I take all the numbers that are smaller than this one and all the numbers that are smaller than this one. And that's and I computed the frequency. So the p-value, I think you have like 3 of 800 that are...
The vertical and horizontal.
Yeah, well, because this is the point for FLS2. This is the point for my... So for FLS2, I have a fin VU that's about -4.
Yes.
Okay. And a Tajimis D that's about -2.7.
If it's -4 to -2.7, are there some specific numbers or?
The number for my receptor of interest, FLS2, the receptor of Flagellin. Sorry, this is.
This is where the
point is.
Line. Okay.
Yeah.
And you look at those which are
below. Yeah. So if you look on me at one, like if you look on me on this, you see that you have a number of loci for which you have a negative fin VU, right? All smaller. So we speak in. On the genomic part, and if you look at this part for D, it's still already quite significant, but it's trying to make significance further.
And why? I don't get it. Why would you be interested in? So for FLS2, you know that it's probably under positive selection.
Well, this is I'm trying to confirm that it is not a demographic effect in that sense.
Yeah, but.
It really is an outlier from the rest of the genome.
And these genes that lie in this area are now a stronger positive selection than FLS2, or?
Possibly.
I
mean, or there's the tail of the distribution, I don't know.
Okay. Right. So if it would be due to a demographic effect, then you would expect lots of points in that gene
area. Yeah,
exactly. Because it affects the whole genome.
Okay. So basically, you want to show that the shaded area is very small. Mm-hmm. That's what. Okay, I see. Sorry.
So he composed that in Chicago with Chandy Vu, and they do something a lot smarter than what I'm doing, right? And they have sort of, and I did it very simple. Okay, so based on that. We thought, okay, it looks like it's departing from mutual expectations, so now we're going to try to see. Let's assume this is true. We have a recent sweep at the FLS2 locus, and we try to understand what has happened. If you had a sweep, you must have had a new function that has evolved at some point, and that was selected in the population, so we should be able to reconstruct what has happened there. The only way to go into this is to go into the data. And so the first thing we did, and this was possible because the flagellin receptor is a single copy gene, and it's specific of flagellin. If you knock out that receptor, you don't detect any flagellin, okay? So it was a very simple way to compare a number of genotypes, and here is different genotypes collected throughout the species range. And what we did is we simply measured how much specific binding you had of a radioactively labeled flagellin fragment, okay? And so, this assay is quite nice because it's pretty reproducible and has pretty low variance. And what we find is that there is a lot of variation for the amount of flagellin binding that you find throughout the genotypes. This is based on a crude protein extract, so there's a lot of things that can explain that variation. But what we were interested to see, so it goes from very, very low levels to very high levels. And what I relate to the rest of the phylogeny is that something common to find so much variation, or is it generally what does 6,000 mean basically for plant species? So how much do you expect for that level of binding?
What's on the x-axis?
The x-axis are different genotypes. So we collected something. I mean, in Arabidopsis thaliana, you have a number of genotypes that have been collected by other people that we have collected too, that you can simply order. And these plants are selfers, okay? So you have like thousands of seeds from the same individuals. They're all clones. You do these clones, extract proteins, and simply check how much they bind to the flagellin.
And which flagellin is this? Which bacterium?
We used something from Pseudomonas. It's the one we use is from a human pathogen, but it's very similar to the plant pathogens. There's actually no difference.
If there is such a strong dependence on the binding from 3 to 4,000, depending on what I presume are small changes in the genotype for the plant, would it also make sense to try to think if the small changes in the flagellin itself would cause equivalently large spreads? ends up binding?
Yes, yes. So the reason why we did this genin residue is because it was known to be the best binding one. And we used different flagellin...
binding to what? To which?
To the FLS2 receptor, to the Arabiopsis-Thaliana receptor. We took another ones that were known. We haven't screened natural populations for that because we don't have any samples from natural populations, and there's not so many bacterial pathogens for Arabiopsis-Thaliana. And so what we did was to take different... from symbionts and from pathogens in other species, found on cultivars, for example. And we could show that actually the one we used has the strongest binding. It's the one that elicits the strongest response to. And so our idea was that if there was other pathogens around, I think I'll get back to that, but if there were, no, wait. This variation that we could see for this one, when we tried it on other ones, it was correlated. So the one with the strongest response for this one was where I saw it. But of course, the whole thing was shifted to its lower binding. Okay, so this one, the one we used having the best binding, it was the one that allowed us to see the broadest range of variation. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I might be talking about this, but is that how you passing specific binding versus general?
Oh, so what you do is, you wash it afterwards first you add flagellin radioactive, and then afterwards you add flagellin that's non-radioactive. That kicks out all the flagellin specific stuff. And the only things that are non-specific is left, and so you subtract that. How you do that. So you basically compete flagellin that's non-radioactive with radioactive flagellin. That's the way you do it.
And are these all populations from the wild in principle?
Yeah, it's not domesticated.
They're all happy living out there. But isn't it weird? Because, I mean, isn't it troubling that they have, like, some of these just don't care about flagellin at all, right? And some do a lot, so.
Yeah, well, this was the question we were asking ourselves. It's like, what does it mean, that amount of variation? I mean, is it a huge amount of variation, or is it just enough? Or, and that's what we're asking in the next.
What's the y-axis? Months. What is this, 2,000, 4,000?
Oh, this is just an arbitrary measure of CPM. It's Cooper minutes. So it's the radioactivity. It's the radioactivity that is.
But they transfer it to millimolars or nanomolars or whatever.
Oh. Why do you need that?
I mean, it could be that even at 500 of this unit, you are still binding at their 1 nanomolar, and at 4,000, you are binding at 0.1 nanomolar, in which case, who cares what the variability, if both of them are so strong that whatever happens. You get a single molecule, you bind, right?
Yeah. So this is raw binding, so to say, and you have different things that go below, and that may explain this variation. It might be the protein abundance, variation in protein abundance, might be variation in affinity. Is this what you're saying? I mean, so this is what I'm going to look into after that. But first, we wanted to know how much of that variation we would see across the phylogeny. And so in green, you have the closest relative, Arabidopsis lorata. And you see that in Arabidopsis lorata, you have also a lot of variation segregating within the species. And in orange, it's a lot of different species in the Brassicaceae. And you see that it goes from a number of species that don't care at all about flagellin to species that are very strongly responding to flagellin. We know we have a little bit of genomic information for some of them. We know that even the locus, so the receptor is implicated, and so on. So there's a lot of variation.
Is there any demographic correlation as well? Like,
sorry?
Is there any demographic correlation between the like high responding?
Not that we could see. No. A lot of these Brassicaceae are actually cultivated plants, so flowers, ornamentals. That's also difficult. So the next question we asked was how much of this would be analyzed by a variation finding imbalance. And so this is just to show you for a couple of queries of different types. We compare these green ones to each other, red ones to each other, and purple ones to each other. The reason why I do this pair by pair is because you have variation in the antigen that is binding to our antibody, and so we can't compare every individual to every other. So when they have the same color, they have the same antigen, and so we can compare them. And so you see that these two individuals, this one has a lot more than this one, and it corresponds to this one and this one. And it matches pretty well, and it's the same for these two red ones and the same for these two green ones. So we find that a lot of this variation in binding that we saw in the first experiment actually translate into differences in protein abundance based on quantification of protein amounts. Okay, so this, the way you do that is here you have whole protein extracts. You reveal the proteins, and you estimate their concentration, and you try to put as much of the protein extract as possible on each of the gel, on each of the wells in the gel, right? And then afterwards, you put a specific antibody that's specific for progenin receptor for FLS2, and this is these bands that you see here. Maybe I should have said. But this is just to tell you that the abundance variation that we find here reflects pretty well the variation we find in binding. And so the next thing we did was to look whether there were some differences in affinity. And the way you do that is you compete your radio label flagellin with different amounts of non-labeled flagellin, and you look at these curves, how well they can compete. And so if you have an individual that doesn't compete so well, then it means that the affinity is lower. And you see that here you have a number of genotypes, and we have basically no significant difference in this curve, indicating that they have the same affinity. There was one individual, and this is this here, that had a completely different affinity and seemed to have much lower affinity. But in general, most of them had the same affinity. We took actually a number of genotypes that were spread that showed very different levels of binding. And the other thing we did is we looked at MMP7. This is an Arabidopsis lorata genotype, so from the close relative. So when we compared it to the close relative, there was no difference also in affinity. Okay. So it seems that, at least in this experiment, we couldn't detect major changes in affinity, with the exception of this genotype that has actually one mutation, so it's very rare. And so it suggests that most of the variation that we see is due to variation in protein abundance, as reported in the previous slide, and affinity only plays a minor role. Yeah? The next thing we looked at was whether there was some variation in allele-specific expression. To try to see whether, if most of the variation is due to abundance, and if it has to be encoded in the FLS2 locus, it's either due to variation in the stability of the protein itself or variation in the cis-regulatory regions. And what I show here is the relative amount of each allele. So 0.5 means you have 50% and 50% of each allele. This is what you expect here in blue for DNA samples of individuals that, so F1 individuals that have been obtained from a cross between these two genotypes. So what you have to see is that Naira Thaliana, it's an inbred plant, so all the plants are homozygote. If you take two plants and you cross them, then you have a plant that's heterozygote all along the genome. If you have allele-specific differences in the expression, then this cannot be due to transregulatory factors. It has to be encoded at the locus that is being transcribed. This is what we call the cis-regulatory cis-regulation. And so what you can see here is that basically when you look at cDNA, so here of plants that have been treated, so confronted with progenin or not, you see that the amount of the relative amount of the two alleles departs from the expectation based on the DNA of these individuals. And so this is a clear indication that you have cis-regulatory differences between these two genotypes. And so we did a number of crosses, and you see you find these differences within these genotypes, within those, And here, you find even a difference that is dependent on the presence or absence of flagellin, which was also quite interesting. So this is really an example where you have a cis-regulatory difference in response to flagellin. Yeah? So the next question we try to ask is, why is there so much variation in FLS2? And so what is important is to try to understand what FLS2 does in the good and in the bad, and the costs and in the benefits, to try to understand whether there might be sort of an optimal that is maintained throughout this. So one of the first things we did was to actually take two individuals that had different levels of binding and cross them and map those differences in the progeny of that cross. And so this is the way we proceed. So those are the plants. We grow them in liquid medium. We add flagellin to this liquid medium. And flagellin blocks growth. And so what we've done was to simply weight these plants after a week or so and map the genetic variation for growth in the presence of flagellin. And for this cross, in which we had differences in FLS2 binding, we could explain with the FLS2 locus about 13% of the variation in growth inhibition, which is quite a lot actually for quantitative trait. We had pretty high heritability. And so this is for one cross where we had differences in binding. When we had no difference in binding, we did actually another two populations. I'm not sure I'm showing this here, but when we had no difference, we wouldn't find FLS2 as a QTL, we'd find other ones. The next thing we looked at was to try to see if there were other consequences of FLS2 on development. And one of the things we looked at was whether you had a change in flowering. We find that in one genotype, we could, so it's not so easy to detect this. What we did was to compare individuals that had a mutation in FLS2 to individuals that had the native FLS2, right? And we simply measured when they would flower it. And we had this in one of these backgrounds, the Landsberg background. And you can see here that you have significantly high later flowering for the one that don't have FLS2. So FLS2, when it's present in the genome and active, then it tends to accelerate flowering time. But this is in the Landsberg background, and we didn't observe this in another background we looked into, but it seems to be background specific. When we looked whether this translates into fitness, what we did was to count the number of fruits. The fruits in Arabidopsis thaliana, they're called seeds. And we had a significant effect of the number of fruits between. So in the absence of a functional FLS2, you have a higher production of fruits, right? So it suggests that when you have a functional FLS2, you have to pay some consequences in terms of what the number of fruits you can produce. This, again, is background specific. So we observed it in the Landsberg background. We didn't observe it in the Columbia background. So what this means is that there might be changes in the background that affect the level at which this function pays off or has consequences in terms of.
This mutation makes the flagellin sensing completely.
And also, wouldn't you assume a lower fitness if the flowering time is longer?
No. You assume higher fitness when your flowering time is longer because your size at maturity is bigger.
And that is more important than being flowering earlier.
Yeah. So the later you flower, the bigger the plant is and the more seeds it can produce. Because you need to feed the seeds.
Time.
Sorry?
The generation time is probably it's not that big a difference anyway, but
no, it's not that.
And you actually measured the fitness. I was just curious why. So I would assume that higher fitness means quicker flowering, and maybe quicker and bigger flowering or something. But
well, then you have to grow super fast.
Yeah,
but the generation time is sort of annual anyway, right?
Yeah,
so that's
annual.
Right. Okay, so it doesn't matter. I see. Yeah, right. That's true. Yeah. Okay.
It doesn't add a generation if you flower earlier.
Yeah, okay.
Fair. Unless you flower a lot earlier. Flowering time is also a very nice trait to study. We also study it, but I'm not talking about it here. Okay, and the next thing is we had to show that there was a fitness benefit to this function, at least. And one of the things we did, and that was in collaboration with Joel Bergerson in Chicago, we measured the bacterial load when we introduced a bacteria that was actually compatible, so that was able to grow in the plant, right? And so what we did is we correlated the amount of specific binding that we detected with the bacterial counts. And it seems that you have sort of a threshold thing where at, if you have too low specific binding, then you're not able to control the bacterial load. It goes very high. And here, it looks like there is a relationship again. So maybe when you have a very, very strong binding, you have a problem. But this is more difficult to assess. But at least it's showing that you need to have some level of binding to be able to control adequately bacterial load.
Yeah, Kush, are there helpful bacteria?
Sorry?
Are all bacteria bad, or?
Are they all bad? No, they're not all bad. This one is just able to infect the plant.
So does the plant want to distinguish between good and bad, or does it just?
It can, but this at this level, flagellin doesn't. Flagellin, it detects flagellin.
Yeah.
Whatever. You have other systems. So the broad spectrum is sort of priming a first level of defense, and some of them first defense can even be used by symbionts to sort of orient their growth. But this is sort of the first level where the plant is sort of, let's see what is coming. And then if it's a pathogen, and that means that the bacterial strain has effectors that it's going to throw into the cell, and either the plant is able to recognize those effectors and then fight them off or not. And that's the next level. But for most of the pathogens, they don't have effectors like that, so it doesn't matter whether, you know, it just cannot grow. Yeah? So because I could show these benefits and costs, so we started to ask this question of the economics of immunity. So what makes the balance between the costs and the benefits in the plant? So we could show that there was an effect on plant performance and there was an effect of defense. On the effectiveness of defense, and so the next step is to understand how these things are balanced. We don't have the full answer to that, but one thing we found that we thought was very interesting was that there was a positive correlation, so it's positive, between so this is the size at maturity, so the number of leaves at maturity, and this is the specific binding. And so the more you bind, the more you tend to have the bigger you tend to be. And so as I've been showing just before, that actually the plants that were mutated tend to flower later, right?
Sorry.
And so
what is the significance of this physical significance of this positive correlation?
Yeah, I should put it here, you're right. It is significant. You want to know, I don't remember, I think it's
If I just remove 2 points or 3 points, right? I will get rid of it, right? But the top point is the top right, and I'll get rid of it.
So take this one out?
This and the top to, and the one to the right.
This one?
The most to the right, the most to the right.
No, but we try to get rid of those. We try to get rid of those. No, it's quite solid. But you're right. I mean, there's a lot of things. It's a very rough correlation, and we need to go into the details to really support it. But what we thought was interesting here is that there was an indication that the individuals that tend to flower later were also those that tended to have a stronger binding affinity. This is not actually in the paper yet because we want to substantiate this further. But what we thought was interesting is that the direction of the correlation is completely opposite of what we see from the mutants. So this means that it's not a correlated effect. It's not because you have more affinity that you flower later, but it's probably that the two things, like the advantage of having a very strong binding allele is there if you're flowering late, but it's not there if you're flowering early. Let me show you how we interpret this. And we have further work that is now ongoing to try to test explicitly that hypothesis. But so this is the idea of your fitness in the presence or in the absence of defense systems. So your fitness is going to depend on whether you're attacked or not. In case you're not attacked, you have a certain fitness level that you can reach that will be lower than the maximum fitness because you have this defense that you have to maintain even though there is no significant attack. And so the individuals that don't have this defense, they would have, in the absence of pathogens, the higher fitness. Okay? And then if you have disease, then the individuals that have a defense will have a lower fitness, so there's a cost of infection, but it will be much lower than those that haven't maintained any defense. Okay? And so this means that the advantage of having these defense will depend on the probability of being attacked. And there's a lot of things that can modulate the probability of being attacked. And one of these things we think might be life history, decisions like when to flower, how big you are, the plant, how long the plant waits until it flowers. And there you have this idea of survival the longer you wait until you flower, the best your survival has to be or your defense has to be. And this is what we're now testing, and we're trying to see whether the cost of having a strongly binding flagellin allele depends on when you flower. And for this, it's quite easy in the system because you can just combine different types of alleles, and you can just see in a relatively simple genetic setting whether late or early flowering magnifies or decreases the cost associated with the presence of a functional receptor.
So in the data that we showed before, you don't really control whether the plants are attacked or not. I mean, it's something that happens.
They're in the greenhouse.
So
they're fine. They have no bacterial disease.
So in this correlation that you showed before, it's not that bacterial diseases don't play a role at all. So there's no benefit in that sense. I mean, in this sense, right? But and still, you have a kind of positive correlation.
Well, yeah, but it's genetic variation, right? I mean, this is.
So how do we know really that they're not attacked in the greenhouse? I mean, there are bacteria there, right?
Yeah, but they're not diseased. Actually, what we did is we sprayed them with bacteria to increase the bacterial load, and it didn't make any difference to what we could see, at least in terms of fitness. So, I mean, what you do in a greenhouse is not necessarily exactly relevant to what happens outside. These plants are defending really well against bacteria, usually, and the strains that people use to study defense to bacteria are actually from cultivars, from tomato, so from a very, very distant species. Yeah? Okay, so far this is an indication that a life history strategies can impact the costs and the benefits of defense, and this is the direction where we're working. I wanted to mention a little bit what we know about the bacterial community, and that was a little bit your question at this point. And this is a paper that's been published in 2006. People have looked at a number of strains in Xanthomonas campestris, which is a natural pathogen, and that you find occurring actually on Arabidopsis thaliana. And what you can see here is that some people have applied MOX or the flagellin that we use, Flag22, or flagellin extract from these different bacterial strains. What you can see is that you have some strains that are able to escape detection by FLSP. So this is what this difference here tells you, right? These strains don't do that. So there is some variation in the ability the natural populations of pathogen in terms of flagellin. So the next question is whether Arabidopsis thaliana responds to that. And we have no evidence that it responds to that because we didn't find much variation in the affinity. So our idea is that actually the pathogen evolves as in response to the presence of the flagellin receptor, but the plant doesn't respond to that directly to that evolution because it has to maintain anyway this sort of growth spectrum, right? So it's not going to follow specific strains, and instead probably this evolution is more subjected to trade-off with the rest of the physiological responses, and whether it's or not its advantages to have a strong innate immune system. Yeah?
Okay, because we see epigenetic responses from the plant, like the variation in the epigenetic, which is acting faster than genetic variation?
I mean, of course you could have that. I'm trying to see how that confined our results. Is that your question?
Yeah, so, I mean, you might have like certain genetic background, but the fast response that actually plant is acting on is the genetic responses. So.
But these are results based on genetic
data. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think. I mean, I think that happens also, right? That the defense response modified the epigenetic state of the whole genome. But this, I have no indication that the genetic differences that I see are due to that. I mean, we have the QTL mapping that tells us that there is variation in at the FLS2 locus. We have the cis resolution variation that tells us that too. But actually, it is also a question to know how much of this genetic variation we see is encoded at the FLS2 locus, or maybe it could be encoded at other epigenetic factors. But I'm not sure what we see between the individuals is actually epigenetic differences. You see what I mean? Just without any DNA difference, sequence difference.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is the first, and I have another part of the story. I'm not sure I'm going to talk. So gene binding is, I think what we've shown is that it's a dynamic function of the Brodsky Casey. That was something when we started the experiment that was absolutely unexpected because people just assume it's taking progenitors conserves, it shouldn't vary. We show that actually the optimal level that you find in the different species is very different. There are multiple molecular mechanisms that contribute to that variation. Some of it is cis regulatory variation, some of it is presumably affinity, although affinity is less prominent. We could show that if the selectivity accelerates the pairing and can reduce the fitness of these on migraine, and that if your giant sensing is positively correlated with sparing type, that suggests that you have this coevolution between the defense and the life history. So we think we find a signature of selection. But if we had a sweep, the amount of variation that we find in the natural population is sort of a little bit weird. You don't expect to find so much variation. And what we think is that there might be a pretty high mutational target size in those species. And actually, what we could show was that if you map the growth inhibition response to flagellin, if you quantified it, and you plot it against the response to another map, which is ELF18, it's another fragment, and receptor for this molecule also known, you find that you have a very strong correlation here between those responses. If you take off these points here that are mutants in either FLS2 or here in ELF18 receptors. So there seems to be a lot of variation that is independent of the specificity of your pump. Of your elicitor, right? The elicitor you use. So this means that there is a lot of variation that is beyond FLS2 in all these pathways that are common to the different receptors. Yeah?
Let me just see that I understand these last two points that you made So on the one hand, if the flagellin sensing is not working, then flowering time is longer, right? So on the other hand, if it's present, then there's a flowering time increases if binding increases.
Well, so there's one that's causative, because in one I compare one line that has FLS2 to a line that doesn't have it.
Yes.
The other one is not causative, because it's just an observed correlation. It just means that the individuals that seem to have strong affinity, tend to be those that also flower later.
But they still don't flower as late as the ones that don't have sensing at all?
So, well...
That seems sort of contradictory, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it means that... So what we don't have is... What we need to have is a mutant of a FLS2 in a late flowering background, which we don't have. And what we think is that the effect of the FLS2 mutation in the late flowering background on fitness will be a lot stronger than on an early flowering background. And this is what we're trying to test now. Because one thing is... The genetic consequences of FLS2, which is to accelerate flowering. So if you would mutate FLS2 in a late flowering background, it would flower earlier. It would flower probably even later.
Oh, I see. But that's the hypothesis.
Yeah. Because you have a lot of variation for flowering time anyway. I mean, flowering time is not controlled by FLS2, right?
Right.
It's controlled by a lot of other things, too. Okay. I can do two things. So I had a long story. I have another 5 minutes, I guess? No? Yeah? So this is another study that I wanted to present, but I'm going to just want to, anyways. What I, it's just to sort of generalize to what we've seen. So at the moment, what I think is that patterns of growth, like life strategy decisions, how fast the plant grows, this is largely, as a, the immune system has very strong consequences on that. This is an example of an interaction between different genes that had been characterized at the genetic level by Ruben Alcazar and the Max Planck Institute in Cologne. And what he's found is that actually you have a number of plants, hybrid plants, that are dwarfs. And these dwarfs result from the presence of one allele in a receptor and one allele in a R gene, a defense response gene. And so there seems to be an interaction between these things that lead to very, very tiny plants. And what Huberman has done was to clone this gene that is responsible for this and to look at the distribution of that gene. And what we've done with him was to try to look at the whether the variation for this gene was subjected to selection, and we could show that actually it is locally selected. I'm not going to show this in detail. I can only show... I don't want to show this in detail. We're showing it in the paper. Maybe I can just show this. If you look at the... I should just show you this first. So if you take individuals from here, so if you take different individuals from here and you cross them to individuals from this area in Asia, you only get these tiny plants when you cross this individual here to a number of these individuals, right? But if you take these individuals here, they never produce this, these dwarfs, okay? So it's really an allele that is locally spread in Asia. And what we did with Ruben was to try to quantify whether this spread here is expected under neutrality or whether we can detect the action of selection on this. And so one thing we did was to quantify differentiation at neutral loci between these regions and then tell whether this allele is an outlier with respect to that. And this is what we're showing here, is that actually this receptor here, receptor kinase that we find, is a very strong outlier. So in general, this is the level of differentiation you expect between these regions, Central Asia and Europe. And for the receptor, you have a very, very strong differentiation that you don't expect from the distribution of the neutral market. So this is an indication that this gene has been subjected to local selection in Central Asia. And what was very, really nice, what Ruben was able to show, that actually this gene is involved in, so if you take an individual and you introduce the other allele, the European allele, you have a much weaker response. So actually the allele that you find in the natural population of Central Asia has a much stronger effect on the triggering of defense. So it's basically sort of a threshold for triggering basal defense that is higher in the Central Asian. It's very nice because the signature of selection that we find seems to be associated with an allele that has a lower threshold for strong defense, so stronger defense responses. And so we think that actually what happens is that you do find a lot of this quantitative evolution of defense responses in our adopted cholera, and a lot of it may be due to the correlation between the defense response and the development. And as a final slide, I can simply show this. This is, again, this balance between benefits and costs. There's a number of things that are going to decrease the benefits and increase the costs, and others that are going to modify the increase the benefits. Of having a defense time.
And so if the environment favors disease, or the environment selects for increased, I haven't talked about this, but, well, so this, those are different plant functions that the environment can select for them, and this will increase the benefits of having a strong defense system. On the other hand, you have, if the environment is not favorable to disease, then the benefit of having defense is going to decrease, and you can increase the cost. And it's in the end, this balance between the benefits and the cost, much of it can be actually driven much more by the environment than by the specificity of the pathogen population. That will drive the evolution of this defense function. So the work I presented on FS2 was the PhD work of Madeleine Feta. I presented very briefly what Ruben Alcazar has been doing in the group of Mathieu Raymond. We just worked on him together with Ilka Kwanhoon, who was a student in my group too. We worked on these signatures of population genetics, trying to understand what was locally selected. And then the work of Madeleine on FS2 was a very tight collaboration with Ilka Bobacek, who's now in England and who is in Suriname. Okay, thank you very much.